I mean, there are loads, thank you very much, Paul. There's just loads of questions that you could ask, so I don't really know which one to ask. But one of the things was just, I was really interested, I mean, the interview is obviously very central to what you're doing.
Mm.
But if you want to really find out what people are doing, then presumably the interview is only one tool to do that.
Yeah.
And so I wondered about the methodology of the project and whether the interviews were supplemented, for instance, I mean, you could get poets to document their processes. I mean, cooperative people, somebody like Brooke Emery, those would probably be cooperative to document what they're doing and then look at how they've actually composed the thing. And you can obviously, there are archives where you can look at things that people have done. I know those things are very incomplete, but they could complement because a lot of the time it seemed to come down to, well, they say that, you know, they're discovering the poem as it goes along, but then what do they actually do? You know, what does it really come down to in concrete terms? But the other thing was that I found the latter part very interesting, because then it seemed to get more onto language and how what they were really doing. They weren't really going into a silence or a vacuum at all. What they were doing was latching on to various things about language and then letting the language kind of converse with itself.
That's exactly the word I would use, is converse.
Yeah.
With regard to the first point, I totally agree. I mean, the interview is a flawed technique for eliciting truth. There are so many different reasons why people will remember things in ways favourable to a particular form of self-presentation that they mightn't even realise is driving them. So they definitely have to be supplemented. And in the book that I've largely written now, thank God, I use these interviews to crack open an issue, but the way I turn for corroboration is not to observation of contemporary poets. So like you said, there are difficulties, there are possibilities, but there are manifest difficulties too, particularly given that most of these people are describing processes of composition that arise in the moment when it wasn't expected and they happen to have a notebook ready. You know, it's hard to set up test conditions for that, even of a qualitative sort, to say nothing of replicable test conditions. But what I do is I look at textual scholarship in other chapters. So I start looking at the manuscript tradition with Romantic poets, and I start to investigate this idea that one might actually produce poetry on the level of, say, Keats' Ode to a Nightingale through extemporization. And when you look at the manuscripts, you can see that in certain cases with the Romantic poets, they really did practice what they preached, and they produced poetry incredibly fast. Keats in particular, Byron as well. Byron was writing cantos of Don Juan in 1 week. Just extraordinary, extraordinary. And that seems to match what he himself says about his compositional process. On the other hand, Wordsworth takes 45 years to revise the Prelude at the same time that he describes poetry as a form of spontaneous overflow. So that's one of the corroborating sources that I look at. Another is the oral formulaic, the tradition of oral formulaic theory, which arises in Homeric scholarship. And basically it involves observation of contemporary oral poets. In the 1930s is when Milman Parry and Albert Lord started doing this. And what they realised is that many poetries in cultures that didn't have writing yet were not actually produced through memorisation and recitation, but they were actually composed on the spot.
So there's a concept in there really of improvisation that you're actually teetering around a lot, I think, isn't there? There's a form of improvisation in there.
Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah. I mean, yeah. My overall conclusion from this is that the contemporary poetry, as in the poetry of the sorts of poets that, you know, whose names I've been reeling off, that it's a lot more improvised than we tend to imagine. But on the other hand, I think it's a lot more revised as well. And what starts to emerge the more I go through these interviews is that people who are saying they're totally into what Auden says, then also reveal, like Emery and Armantrout, that they also happen to spend years revising these poems. And I think they're doing both. I think that the word romantic, words like romantic and romanticist, have not done us too many favours because they've given us an easy way to pigeonhole anything that seems to smack of what Auden's talking about there. And it seems to me that what's actually happening is a complex interplay between improvisation and revision. As for conversation, yeah, I think that's what people are doing. I think that's what improvisation is.
It's on language rather than just if you go into a vacuum and there's nothing in your mind.
Yeah.
That they get a phrase.
Yeah, when you press people, that's...
Yeah, that's what.
And this is, again, to do with the problems with self-report, though, too, in interviews, that some people have the observational acumen and in some cases the theoretical training to realise that's what's happening, and some people don't. It's always a mixed bag. But I think that's very much what's going on. Yeah.
No, great paper.
Oh, thank you.
Interesting. I'm just wondering if there's a couple of levels of paradox or sort of underlying potentials of multiple meanings in some of what's sort of going on. When they're talking about speaking and writing, there's the number of parts that you mentioned that was very interesting. And talking about a process that seems to involve extemporizing and actually deliberately and consciously involving that kind of method. But then the work itself is finished. And this is also true in the way you were describing the interview. The interview is a process which might be oral, but then it becomes a text, and the text is then potentially edited. And it begs the question of what people, and I think they would also probably be asking themselves that question, what they mean, but what Auden means by speech, in the sense that I think there's a double meaning to what he's saying with speech, but he really means writing. But he also really means reading. So that it's actually, and some of the things that Brooke Emery was saying, that this idea of the reader getting the same perceptions as the poet, but that involves you reading what's on the page as if you're speaking it yourself, in a sense. And so, those layers of paradox then make it even more difficult, I think, to unpack. But I think you are kind of touching on very interesting things, but it's very paradoxical with these sorts of relations.
Well, look, whenever you go to Auden for a quote, you're going to get paradox, and you're going to get... multiple layers of ambiguity, because when you trace that quote back to its source, I'll put it up. Where are we? You trace this back to its source, which is in Secondary Worlds. These are the T.S. Eliot lectures that were given in 1967 or thereabouts. This is the last of them. It's an incredibly confounding lecture. It is all over the place. It's full of these huge block quotations that are kind of undigested. It seems that the late Auden, he was prepared to kind of take the money and do the job, but it's not as finely worked as any of the poetry, for instance, his prose poetics. But what's basically happening in this lecture is that he's insisting that poetry is a form of speech, that it takes us to the space of speech, that it's produced that way, and on the other side of that, that it aspires to that sort of texture. Yeah, and if you like, the hidden operator there is writing as the way by which it performs that ruse. But nonetheless, Auden is adamant in this lecture that poetry is, he says, it's a form of personal speech in its most intimate form. He rejects the idea that it is writing in the way that other literary genres are written. But I think that what he's actually doing is saying that this is what poetry is in its ideal, in its aspiration, but actually it's a sham. It's a kind of Kierkegaardian gesture, because he ends up saying that the real intimate speech is with God. And it's the one that we have with our Maker in those existential moments where you're face to face with that other being. And it's an I-thou interaction. poetry, he ends up implying, is actually a sham attempt to get that kind of closeness and experience of the word that you can only really have through, religious congress of the fear and trembling sort. I, by the way, don't buy any of that stuff, like, because I'm not a Christian. And I realise the more I read into this that Auden thoroughly is by this point. He's really speaking Kierkegaard, you know, well and truly. So that actually, even though he sets this up as an ideal for poetry, he then kind of rips it away and suggests, yeah, in a way that it's a kind of a sham. It's a fake form of speaking. I mean, and that for me is a real question about poetry too, that the more one mines into these and other materials, the manuscript record and so forth, the more you realise how multiply revised poetry is, how rarely it is that a poem actually arrives as a straight extemporisation, even though it kind of feels that way on the page. I tend to start asking myself, well, is poetry actually a form of fiction? Is that really the genre we should put it in? Not a fiction in terms of its content, but a fiction in terms of the type of enunciation that it presents as. A lyric poem presents as a, in the present moment, speaking directly to you utterance. But that's kind of fictive if you have to go through 10 drafts to produce it. If it's not actually a possibility of human speech, it's kind of fiction. And they're the sort of directions that Auden pushes us in that lecture. But thank you for and putting that away in terms of writing. Yeah, that illuminates for me further what he's doing, actually.
Can I ask a question about kind of ties into like this notion of like self-report?
Yes.
And self kind of mythologization. Because I was wondering, I mean, just at the end there, you kind of went on to talk about, you know, actually, is it really a form of fiction what people are doing? And in poetry, it seems like there's a much more, the figure of the poet, the role of the poet, the self-identification of the poet feels like it's much more pronounced and much more significant than it is in the realm of fiction.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering how much of what people's response is actually to do with a kind of wish to conceptualize themselves. Than it is to do with the actual words on the page and the text that's produced. And a kind of almost a wish to take on a kind of pseudo-religious, you know. At the beginning, I open myself up to, we might call it flow, or we might call it inspiration, we might call it, you know, but I'm channeling these, you know, transcendental energies. And then what I do, so there's no intention. And then once I've sucked this, you know, nugget, then I sit down and I become a craftsman, and I switch the intention on then. But this notion that I don't know, it just seems like it's very hard to imagine a fiction writer, you know, kind of doing that. Maybe it's to do with the fact that at 80,000 words, you know, it's a very different beast.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And also with the work of fiction, you're dealing with things like, you know, really, you know, things like character and plot and, you know, setting and, you know.
It's hard work,
yeah,
man.
Whereas with, you know, with a poem on one page that's 50 words, that's 60 words, you don't have to do some of those. I don't know, I was just wondering, that's not really a question, but it's more like, you know, how would you translate this?
really quickly? So five words that stuck out for me over the course of your presentation were epiphany, revelation, inspiration, altitudinous, and intuition, all of which have definitional or etymological relations to religion.
Yeah.
And then they're not all the poet's words, some of them, I think. I checked were your words, I can't remember exactly.
Altitudinous, definitely mine.
Right. But perhaps the rest of them...
And I'm quoting Thomas Brown, Religio Medici. Yeah.
But that might reflect even more upon that question.
Yeah. Look, I would put it this way. C.K. Williams ended up saying something which really hit me on the head like a shovel, you know, when you kind of bounce like in a cartoon. He said, look, you're asking all these questions about improvisation, about spontaneity, you know, that's where all this stuff, or where a lot of this stuff leads. And he said to me, when you think about it, any art form is experienced as spontaneous, as almost improvised. Like when we read a poem, we can't help but almost feel like it's almost coming at us in the moment as a present, continuous act of speech. Just like when you see a film, it feels like the action is occurring right before you, even though you know it took months to make. You know there were multiple shots. You know it's all been edited together. But somehow we suspend our disbelief in the act of its having been produced to experience it as a kind of coming at us in the present phenomenon. Just like when you're listening to a song, you know, it feels like it's actually singing in the moment, even though you know it took ages to produce and so
that's
forth.
That's not just art, though. Like, that's the world.
Well,
like,
it's academic.
Experience
it's
of the world, you know, so you can walk out here and walk through the garden, and that garden's constructed, and it's been thought out, and it's been designed, but your experience of it is as a...
Yeah.
Sudden revelation.
I agree entirely, and I think it's the same with a novel. It feels like someone is telling you a story, even though it took so many drafts and everything. We just bracket all of that out. We forget about the fact that it was produced, and we experience it, like Benjamin says, like a storyteller who's sinking the story into us. So this is William's explanation for why people get duped into believing what Auden's saying about their own compositional practice. He was almost saying they're being mesmerised by the end product. But actually, you know, they're forgetting. They're wiping out of their mind all the work that actually went into it. Nonetheless, the fact that we tend to experience poems that way, let me generalise and universalise, and you guys can disagree with me if I'm wrong, but my sense is that he's right, that we tend to take poetry in that way. And I think in literary studies, we often study it that way. We talk about artworks... as if one can see what the author was thinking throughout rather than thinking about them as 500 different compositional acts all agglutinated together by a person who was different 2 weeks ago to the one who's there now. You know, we're happy to subsume them within one homogenous authorial intentionality. I think by dint of the same compelling present tenseness of art. That being the case, when you read something extraordinary by Blake, it's hard not to think... wow, that guy just sits there and gets thoughts like that. You know, or similarly with Robert Lowell or whoever you're reading, it's hard not to kind of think, wow, that's how their brain actually works. As opposed to, oh, this is a guy who worked for months and months and months trying to cobble these words together on the basis of some crappy initial go. So I think there's something in the way we experience art, in other words, which predisposes us to create a particular type of author or to imagine a sort of author. And lyric poetry in particular, because it's so shortened and condensed, really lends itself to us imagining genius, inspiration and so forth but in processes that might be more complex.
But it's also like it goes all back to Matthew Arnold and the cult of art as like secular salvation, you know, and God's dead, so let's have art objects. And this is what and it's not surprising then that Don Patterson produces a book of aphorisms and cultivates paradox, you know, in order to further this notion that it's in contradiction that you really see, you know, both the essence of what real poetry should be and the essence of what art is.
It, well, what really interests me is the links between the pre-Renaissance mystic tradition and contemporary poetics, because there's so much resonances between, say, John of the Cross and T.S. Eliot, or, you know, so many modernist poets that you care to think of. I'm not surprised that people leap to religious words or religious analogies to explain some of these aesthetics. And we can say that in the sort of way Foucault would, we can imply that their project is still just a religious one. Or we might read it backwards and say, actually, all of those religious people, all of those mystics, what they were really doing was poetry, and religion was just, you know, a word you could grab to peg onto it. Yeah. I mean, why not read it back the other way? I'd prefer to think of it that way. And certainly philosophy has a genesis in Descartes really has a very close link to religious texts of self-exploration in the late Middle Ages that then gets generically pegged to philosophy since Descartes. But really, he's doing something very similar to the Thomas A. Kempis in The Imitation of Christ, or, you know, many a religious divine. So that'd be my explanation for why the religious language gets there.
So does that mean, just to continue on that thing, does that mean that those who reject the Auden quote, they're kind of like the atheist poets?
They're going to hell.
They're, I think...
So, I mean, like, just because I think that what you have, like, and I think, you know, that, you know, like in kind of the poster voice for atheism,
yeah,
you know, like, they kind of represent that duality, and in some ways that's a binary, you know, between belief in God or not, that is a kind of Western construct. And you know, like, between monotheism and atheism, that's a kind of Western construct. And you know, maybe that's partly why in all of these Anglophone writers these things are coming up. Whereas if you look at some other tradition, you would get different language or a different kind of relationship to religious experience through poetry.
Look, yeah, you know, very... I think that would have to be the case. I would say, though, with our unbelievers, people like Williams, C.D. Wright, the people who are most opposed to Auden, nonetheless, I think it was pretty clear from what they said, particularly with Williams, what they're aspiring to in their poetry is exactly the same texture that Ray Armantrout is looking for, or that Brooke Emery is looking for. They want a poem that feels like it is not just speaking in the moment, but speaking in dialogue, in conversation, in the moment.
So they really believe it's, you know, they're professing to be atheists.
Well, no, I would just say that they want a particular texture, a particular type of reading experience to be created, and they've got a different technique for getting there. You know, I'd actually put it down ultimately to a matter of technique. Like, people like Armantrout and Emery are finding that the best way to get there is to speak off the top of their heads. Whereas people like Williams and Wright are, I think, at once being a bit coy on the element of speaking off the top of their heads that is actually integral to what they do, but also they are really focusing on the editing work as a way of getting there. But they're ultimately talking about the same goal. And it is to create this sense of presentness that is, yeah, it is fetishistic. It's not real, but it's real to the way we interact with reading. And I think you're right, Matt. It's real, too, to the way that we perceive the garden as we walk out there, instantly arriving at all these, you know, Kantian categories of space and time and so forth. Yeah.
Isn't there a whole category of poets who are sort of missing here, though, that people... I just want to say this, because, I mean, there are a lot of people who start with a system when they write, don't they?
Yeah.
I mean, like the poets that...
Or Goldsmith.
I mean, there's hordes of conceptual poets. So it seems as if the emphasis of your study, and a lot of what you're saying, is to do with lyric poetry and lyric poets, loosely speaking.
Yeah.
But there is a whole other type of poet who really works in a completely different way, I think, would start the system. And would have something rather different to say about
it. Yeah, I think that's the case. Like, we've really gone for, what's the word? We're tracing the lines of power. You know, we're looking at who wins the Premier's Prizes, who wins the, who appears in the anthologies and so forth. You know, the nation-based anthologies, so that those sort of poets are not getting as much airtime in this sort of analysis. Goldsmith was really interesting to talk to, though. Now, in his case, he didn't profess that he wants a text that feels like it has this present tense speaking to it, but he certainly produces work like that. Like, that book, The Weather, is actually beautiful to read because you hear the voices coming through with these radio presentations, and they're full of metaphor, and they tell stories about the skies, you know, meteorological fairy tales. They're just weather reports. And his seven American deaths and disasters is, again, a sort of text that really speaks. When I've taught it to students, the students really feel it almost as if they're hearing the broadcasts. But that's not going to cover all conceptual poets by any means. Yeah, I agree.
But the,
I agree.
You know, there are a lot of people now writing that.
Yeah.
You've already kind of covered half of it, I think, but I want to go back to it just in case there's any more to draw out. Because I feel like we've talked a lot about the two-thirds who feel inspired in one way or another, or agree with the Auden quote. As I was wondering about the other third and how much they felt, as well as disagreeing with the quote, how much they also felt some inspiration to one degree or another. And I was also curious about whether there was anyone who said that they both agreed and disagreed with the quote, or thought it was completely irrelevant, or did everybody have a position one way or the other?
Well, C.K. Williams was the person who came out right and just said it's not a very fruitful quote.
That's after agreeing with it, though.
He did. He said, Auden's utterly brilliant, one of the most brilliant minds ever. And then he slowly, torturously took me through every way in which the quote was stupid and one that I should certainly have not presented to him, because why am I wasting his time? But I think he's totally right, actually. And for some of the reasons Anthony raised too, you know, there's real paradox, ambiguity. It's covering so many different areas, that quote. You can read it for so many different ways. That on some levels it's a totally fruitless quote and we shouldn't have put it before people. And the more you explore the answers, the more you realise the people who say yes are often saying yes to a very different thing to the other person who says yes. But on another level, I kind of find that fun. Like, I like something that sends the field off in way different directions. And actually, I start by quantifying it and saying two-thirds and so forth. But in a way, that's a little jibe at my colleagues who are being very quantifying about these materials, whereas I think they're kind of funny because you can say there's two-thirds, but when you unpack it, actually, a lot of the people who are really pro the Auden have the same position as Williams or as Wrights. You know, it's a matter of getting further into their language and realising it.
It's like spontaneity and then kind of redrafting in their response.
Well, yeah, there's that as well.
Did people go the other way? Did people say, no, I disagree, but then go into saying, but ultimately I feel like I have some...
I think that, again, why I like this quote is that in some ways it kind of opens some floodgates because, like, spontaneous overflow as a phrase is almost a swear word, you know. It's pretty, what's the word? I've been to conferences where I've heard people quote it as an instance of the nada of romantic poetics. And you've got to further define that, and obviously they mean something like something that comes from an extra-linguistic source that appears just in the individuality of the poet, and so forth and so forth. But having Auden seem to say something a little bit like Wordsworth, I think did give people a space to talk about something they know technically as a technique that they rely on constantly, but that is in some ways kind of theoretically disqualified. And in that sense, it was kind of useful to have this all-over-the-place quote that could just let people head in different directions with it, but feel justified in saying it because Auden had said it. You know, I mean, Auden... I mean, I think C.K. Williams is scary, but Auden himself is probably a bit scary in some ways, you know.
Two last questions.
Okay.
I was going to ask, actually, the same question as Hazel about conceptual poets and sort of more prose process-based and technique-based poetry, but almost to flip it and say, what about the practice of that within lyric poetry? And you touched on that. I can't remember. Was it Waldrop who said that a lot of the poems that he sat down to write intellectually as exercises actually resonated more as sort of having some effect on his brain.
Yeah, yeah.
But that there's sort of like a bit of an unspoken code or something that we don't reveal process. And I guess my question is, do you think that this speaks more to the sort of category of lyric, or perhaps the institutions and the award systems as being sort of steeped in a religious tradition of aesthetics as being sort of the thing on the pedestal as opposed to process, that sort of for reasons of vanity or self-preservation of image that sort of skews the whole thing and the whole conversation in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Look, I'm realising actually I have been downplaying the element of people who you would probably put in a conceptual kind of framework, because Paul Hoover and Maxine Chernoff are both very much poets who write in that vein. Hoover edited the fantastic anthology of postmodern American poetry. I think one of the best anthologies of contemporary American in the last 50 years. Amazing book. But it's Hoover who is finding so much in the Auden comment. And similarly Chernoff, even though they write very much within those traditions. And Ray Armantrout is someone who one would certainly label as avant-garde and would, I think from the texture of her work, I was surprised when she described it as lyric, because it seems so fragmentary and strange. So that actually, you know, quite a few of the people I spoke to would tend to be categorised that way. And they're not the ones who are rejecting the Auden, which, you know, is another kind of intriguing thing there.
The quote sort of speaks only to the thing of riffing or improvising,
yeah.
Even if it takes like a source, like a phrase or something as a source. But what I guess, and obviously that's the focus of your study, but I think there's an interesting comparison, because most of these poets, they would have the sort of inner monologue poems as well as experimenting more with techniques and maybe mining other texts and using more source materials. And so I guess for me the interesting part is how that conversation then moves over to when you're not taking the self-source.
Yeah, well, like Hoover, for instance, has a book where he takes one of the Shakespeare sonnets, I forget which, and he rewrites it 65 times. It's a bit... and each time it's a different genre. You know, again, you'd probably call it a process-oriented work. And he was saying that each time you do that, sure, you're following a process, but in the moment of doing it, In the moment of trying to work out what's the next word, process oriented or not, it's got to come from somewhere. And he was not seeing a great distinction, I guess, between something process driven, like that, you know, rewrite this sonnet that's already been written, that's been around for 400 years, but do it in a different genre each time. He was saying that still that involves coming up with it on the spot, like all, you know, human communication, relying upon all these received discourses and everything that we carry with us.
I suppose it depends on the system of rules. Like there would be some that would be more rigorous that wouldn't allow such a curation.
Yeah, it's true. But no, well, what I would say is that, you know, again, some conceptual work does that, and what it does is basically set up a frame whereby whatever language the world gives, which might be whatever gets recorded on this tape deck if we just leave it in a cafe or something like that. You know, whatever words arrive become the words of the poem. Let's say that as an experiment. What it seems to me happens in those cases is that those words take on almost a fetishistic quality of their own, where they feel somehow elevated above just the normal chit-chat that we have by the fact that they've fallen within that frame. That conceptual frame, if you like. And the people who are saying those words aren't intending to produce a poem or anything like that. But the language is getting this presentness, this vividness to it, that is something like what Armantrout or Emery are aiming at.
Because the texture seems to be really emphasised, but maybe people are a bit reticent to talk about the process by which they arrive.
But
what sort of reveals some like sort of hoax.
All right, so let's wrap up. That's
okay. Oh, there's much more to talk about that. Yeah, this is great.
Really wants to ask
Neil,
how
are you for the last question?
Just in regard to this idea of the genuine,
yeah,
this idea that Auden's idea that the genuine is related to spontaneity, but even the premeditated has some spontaneous origin, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
So is this kind of dichotomy, the spontaneous and the premeditated, a false one, perhaps? Where do you draw the line between something that is premeditated and something that is spontaneous?
I think it's false. I think every single sentence we speak is made up with prefabricated materials, but in the process of speaking it, we do not actually know where it's going to finish as we set out on saying that sentence. I think academic speech is full of improvisation. I think that's why we have conferences, because, you know, we can't edit what we say, and we sometimes arrive at really curious places in the process. I think that's speech. And it's why it's fun. I think, and I think it's what lyric in particular taps into, and what's so exciting about it is that it reveals that our everyday speech has this spontaneity and uncertainty and risk about it. Yeah, even though it's kind of all been said before, but still, you don't know where it's going to end before you bring that sentence to an end.
I know where it's going to end.
I don't believe you.
It's going to end now. I think the degree of questions and the fact that everybody was really stimulated and provoked by this is real testament to how fascinating the project is.
Thanks, man.
And how great a job that you're doing with it.
Thank you.
You're in very much danger of being invited to come back here on a fortnightly basis and make the drive up from Canberra.
Oh, but it's the drive down from Canberra.
Oh, the drive down.
800 metres.
Oh, sorry. I was going like in the Antarctic direction. I'm still working. I work globally. But please join me in thanking Paul McGee for a phenomenal talk. And feel free to come and barrage him with more questions.
Well, do you guys go for lunch? Like, is that
yeah,
is that a tradition? Great.
So yeah. So well, I'm gonna take off for lunch to the mill.
Oh, okay, mate.
I'll come to the mill and have some chips.
Great. Thanks.
And for you, other things, very welcome to join us.